Place yourself in an endless sea of sand and rock. You awkwardly stumble over the shifting sands beneath your feet, seeking some reprieve from this empty, sublime landscape. The clear sky above you gives little to the land, with rain being of incredible rarity in this part of the world. You are in the Idehan Albari, one of the driest regions of one of the driest places on Earth, the famous Sahara Desert. Located on the southwest fringes of modern Libya in the Fezzan region, the Idehan Albari resembles to a T the most stereotypical view of the Sahara, a dune sea devoid of all life. Surely a land this hostile must be one free of history. After all, how could human beings, with our many material needs and wants, have ever decided to call this place home? As adaptable as we are, this region is so sparse today, how could it possibly have been inhabited in the past, much less before the advent of the modern technology we rely on so dearly? And then, in the distance, you see it. A small town, inexplicably located in this harsh land. The town is located in a valley. On one side, the winding sand dunes of the Idehan Albari, and on the other side, an equally bleak rock escarpment. But within the valley, while the ground is still beige sand, there are trees, shrubs, and other plant life. There are people. While most of the buildings are modern, running along a highway, a large cluster on the side appear ancient and abandoned. The ancient city is no humble settlement, but an antique metropolis, a city that must have rivaled other great urban centers of its era. The city is called Jerma. And as you continue your journey through the valley, you realize that this is far from the only city of its kind. Some, like Jerma, remain close to modern population centers, while other equally grand ancient cities are isolated in seemingly arbitrary spots in the desert. Questions swirl around in your mind. Who are these people who built these great cities in the sand? How did they transform such a hazardous land into a comfortable home? And, perhaps most importantly of all, what happened to reduce their ancient cities into crumbling ruins? Welcome to the newest season of the History of Africa podcast, where we will investigate the story of one of history's most fascinating ancient civilizations, the Garamantes. Who were these ancient city builders of the Libyan desert? What do we know about them, and what remains unknown to us even today? Throughout this season, we will attempt to answer these questions, and also be forced to reconsider the supposed dichotomy between Africa north and south of the Sahara. So hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Africa podcast. I'm your host, Andy. Let us take our first steps today into the vast and mysterious history of the Garamantes civilization. Season 5, Episode 1, Paintings in the Desert. The name Sahara Desert is a somewhat funny one. The etymology of the name almost certainly derives from the Arabic word al-Sahraw, Arabic for desert. So when we call it the Sahara Desert, we are in fact calling it the Desert Desert. Oddly enough though, this twist of linguistics is actually kind of perfect. If there's one place in the world that is such a desert that it deserves the title twice, it's the Sahara. After all, it is the largest hot desert in the world, and, well, it's not even particularly close. Along with the Arabian Desert, the Sahara has served as the primary influence of the archetypical desert aesthetic. But while much of the Sahara, including the area which we will be focusing on the most in the series, does resemble those stereotypical rolling seas of sand dunes interrupted only by the rare and enigmatic oasis, it turns out that this 9 million kilometer stretch of land is far from monolithic. Even just within the region of the Fezzan, the desert can change dramatically in appearance. Chains of volcanoes dominate parts of the region, with one enormous cluster of volcanoes, the Haruj al-Aswad, being particularly noticeable. This volcanic landscape in the desert produces an otherworldly environment, with tendrils of black hardened basalt stretching across the terrain, with wind filling the crevices in between with sand. It is easily the most noticeable geographic feature of Libya when viewed from space, something that can only be described as a, well, geological melanoma on the landscape. Look at a satellite image of it and you will see exactly what I mean. Due to the rarity of water and vegetation, the main source of erosion in the Sahara has always been wind. As a result, the gradual effect of wind on rock can create some truly wondrous rock formations, which seem to almost defy physics. But while water is rare in this desert, it does exist, and not only in the form of oases. In fact, when it comes to the region's human history, by far the most significant geographical feature is the Wadi. We've discussed Wadis briefly before in this show, way back in our episodes on Yemen and its relationship with ancient Ethiopia. A Wadi is a type of geographic feature present in many arid regions around the world, including, of course, the Libyan Sahara. See, the Libyan Sahara receives far too little rain to support any permanent rivers, with Libya being the largest country on planet Earth to not feature a single permanent river. Wadis are instead the closest thing Libya has. They are ephemeral streams, formed from accumulated water from rare spurts of rainfall. These streams flood maybe once every few years, and typically last a couple weeks, leaving the wadis usually resembling a small valley with a dry stream bed near the center. A wadi, known as Wadi al-Ajal, a long valley wedged between two of the most hostile regions within the Libyan Sahara, and the valley you wandered into in our hypothetical second-person narrative at the start of this episode, would go on to be the main nexus of Garamantian civilization. But our story today begins long before the formation of the Garamantes, and even before the rise of known settled agriculture. In the truly distant past, the landscape in which the Garamantes would one day call home looked markedly different from its current state. See, the Sahara operates in a roughly 22,000-year-long climate cycle of relative humidity or dryness. Very slight wobbles in the Earth's axis disrupt monsoon rain patterns, ensuring that they either do or don't reach the Sahara. During these wet parts of the cycle, the Sahara was not much of a desert at all, but is rather described better as a semi-arid grassland, resembling those famous savannas that you can find further south in present-day Africa. Higher rainfall also allowed for the support of several large permanent rivers across the Sahara, which in turn fed into the creation of multiple large lakes. One of these so-called paleo lakes, a much expanded version of the still extant Lake Chad, covered an extensive swath of land and was for a time the largest lake on planet Earth, which paleoclimatologists refer to using the incredibly badass-sounding name, Lake Mega-Chad. Another one of these paleo lakes, known as Mega-Fezzan, stretched across much of the modern Fezzan region of Libya, meaning that what is today dry rolling sand dunes of the Idehan Obari were, in fact, covered with water only a dozen millennia ago. The prehistoric Saharan savanna, too, was populated with animals, both ancient extinct species, along with some that would still be familiar to us today. And one of those familiar species was, of course, us. Humans have an incredibly long history of living nomadic hunter-gatherer lifestyles across the then Sahara grasslands, with some of the oldest human remains being found in the Sahara. It's possible, even, that Homo sapiens may have first evolved in the Sahara. Generations of people lived in the region, gathering its edible plants and hunting its animals. Of course, this population came and went depending on how hospitable the region was, whether it was in the dry or wet part of its climate cycle. These early people of the Sahara left their traces on the land both unintentionally, through the existence of ancient campsite remains, and intentionally as well, in the form of rock art, which gives us a surprisingly clear window into the lives that these prehistoric Saharans led. The shifting styles of what they depicted, the materials they used to depict it, and how they drew what they saw around them can provide insight not only into their culture, but also into their lifestyle. There are five main styles of Saharan rock art which concern us today. The oldest of these relevant styles of rock art is what's called the Boubalin style. That name, Boubalin, refers to a type of now-extinct water buffalo species, which is the animal most commonly depicted in this period of art, and therefore the animal which gives its name to the style. Now, the exact timetable of when the Boobaline era begins and ends is pretty hotly debated, but Boobaline-style artwork is generally believed to have emerged between sometime around 10,000 and 8,000 BC. This style of art is composed not of paintings and drawings, but rather deep and neatly cut engravings in stone. As you might imagine from its name, the Boobaline style emphasizes the natural world most of all, especially animals. Animals, whether they be gazelle, antelope, buffalo, elephants, giraffes, ostriches, leopards, or anything else that lived in this landscape, occupy the main space of most Boobaline artwork, with the engraving usually focusing on a specific animal as its central piece. Humans, too, are sometimes depicted alongside these animals, but are disproportionately small compared to them, signifying their relative unimportance in the culture of those who produced these works. And when they are depicted, humans in Boobaline art are not only small, but often depicted with animalistic heads. Boobaline art is widely assumed for this reason to be a product of a firmly hunter-gatherer society. Hunter-gatherers, as people who relied heavily on animals for their daily food and material needs, emphasized the importance of these creatures to their lifestyle. In accordance with its naturalistic perspective, Boobaline art was down to earth in what it depicted. Most scenes depicted in the art are things that would have been ordinary and familiar sights to those who made them. Animals simply existing, or animals being hunted by humans. However, Saharan rock art would not retain this naturalistic perspective forever. Shortly following the emergence of Boobaline art, another, distinctly different style of rock art emerged. This style is known as Gel Isuf art, meaning ghosts of the wilds in the local Tamashek language, due to archaeologists receiving the suggestion from a local guide that the isolated rock art style was made not by human beings, but by spirits that inhabited the desert in local Tuareg mythology. If you want to learn more of the legendary Kel Isuf spirits of Amazigh mythology, the role that these stories of ghostly desert beings have played in North African society then and now, and what the stories of these spirits can tell us about the history, culture, and lifestyle of the people of North Africa, then you will love our new premium episode at patreon.com/historyofafrica. Our newest premium episode will take a deep dive into the legends of the Kel Isuf, how they simultaneously represent so many contradictory values of danger, longing, solidarity, and nostalgia. And, most interestingly of all in my opinion, how they offer us a window into the perceptions of mental strife and depression in the indigenous cultures of the Sahara, and how these communities attempted to remedy these problems. If you want to hear more about the Kel Isuf, then you can access the episode by supporting us on Patreon. It goes a long way into helping the show continue to happen. And to those already supporting us on Patreon, a heartfelt thank you. Unlike Boobaline art, the Kel Isuf art style places a greater emphasis on human beings rather than the animal world. The main motif of this art style is its simple geometric representation of human beings, drawn in the form of solid oval shapes with arms, legs, and genitals, while animals are almost completely absent from this style of art. Notably, there is essentially no overlap in the locations of Kel Isuf art and Boobaline art, with the two styles rarely or really almost never coexisting on archaeological sites. This might indicate that the two styles were composed by different cultures, and that the anthropocentric nature of Kel Isuf art might indicate a stronger anthropocentric way of thinking among its creators. Around approximately 7000 BC, though, rock art in the Sahara began a dramatic transformation. In sites associated with Kel Isuf art, a new style began to take hold and replace it, often being painted over old Kel Isuf engravings. Known as round head rock art, this style is similarly anthropocentric, but varies from its predecessor in a few different ways. For starters, unlike Kel Isuf and Boobaline art, round head art is painted rather than engraved, with prehistoric Saharans dipping their hands in a red paint made out of a combination of mud and iron oxide. In roundhead art, the images of human beings become much more detailed, with bodies represented by distinct heads, torsos, and legs, rather than simple ovals with appendages sticking out. Furthermore, men and women are now recognizably distinct within the art, with female figures possessing larger hips and breasts than male figures. Roundhead art also features human beings in dynamic poses, performing different activities such as hunting, gathering, looking after children, dancing, performing rituals, and making pottery. Some of the pottery from the Roundhead period is still with us today, with it being considered some of the most advanced and high-quality pottery made by hunter-gatherers in the history of humanity. Animals are more present in Roundhead art than in Kelesuf, but are sized more accurately relative to humans than in the Bubaline carvings, indicating a growing equality of importance between human and animals within the minds of their artists, and a greater importance placed on realism rather than emphasis. Roundhead art style would remain the dominant style of art throughout the next several millennia of Saharan history. However, while the art style would remain relatively similar, the types of scenes depicted in rock art of the Roundhead style would begin to shift around 6000 BC, with the introduction of pastoralism into the Sahara. The exact process for the introduction of domesticated animal herding into the Sahara is poorly understood and hotly debated to this day. Some scholars have posited that pastoralism must have entered the Sahara through the movement of outsiders, nomadic herdsmen from the northern coast of Africa, into the region, or perhaps people from the Nile Delta making their way in. Others have argued that it may have been an internal invention, that the practice of herding domesticated animals arose independently in the Sahara, like it did in many other parts of the world. Regardless, what we do know is that the transition of herding animals in the Sahara was not an overnight or total transformation. Rock art from the pastoral period, as it's known, often shows hunter-gatherers and cattle herders coexisting with each other in the same artistic renderings. In some art, it's heavily implied that cattle herders themselves still relied heavily on hunting and gathering, with one rock art scene in southeast Algeria showing a group of men surrounded by a herd of cattle, but these men are butchering and eating a wild antelope. However, there are notably no scenes of art, to our knowledge, that depict conflict between herders and hunter-gatherers. In some cases, there is strong evidence for the cohabitation of shelters by pastoral and hunter-gathering people, as art depicting each lifestyle appears alongside each other. At no point is one type of art painted on top of the other, indicating a degree of reverence for each other group's creations. One archaeologist, Jitka Sokopova, even speculates that this might show that the pastoralists place a sense of religious significance on hunter-gatherer art, as pastoralist ritual altars often coincided with spaces used as Roundhead art locations. Roundhead and pastoral art both contain similar religious motifs, including figures of people wearing animalistic masks, while the remains of cattle and wild animals alike are often included around these paintings, indicating that animal sacrifice was likely a shared practice among both groups. However, while these two groups were able to largely coexist with each other, the forces of nature would begin to gradually make life more difficult for the hunter-gatherers. Even prior to the arrival of the pastoralists, the shifting cycle of the Sahara's monsoon winds led to rainfall becoming less and less common over time. The rivers throughout the region were reduced to a trickle, and then eventually became only seasonal wadis, if even that. The lakes saw their water levels fall, with some of them, like Lake Chad, becoming tiny remnants of their former selves, while others, like Lake Megafizan, ceased to exist altogether. The grasslands and occasional trees dotting the region began to dehydrate and die, replaced by more drought-resistant short grasses. This change in climate is indirectly reflected in the art of the Saharan people. As the grasses became shorter, they could not support the diets of the large megafauna. Elephants, rhinos, and giraffes vanished from Saharan art altogether, replaced with antelope, gazelles, and wild cattle. But the desertification didn't end there, as this fauna too became increasingly rare. Over time, even those drought-resistant short grasses were unable to cope in the ever more arid Saharan landscape. They too were replaced, not by a new type of grass, but by sand and rock. As it became harder and harder to find big game to hunt, hunting and gathering became an impossible lifestyle to maintain, and pastoralism became dominant. Not all of the Sahara was affected equally, and yes, a few pockets of relative moisture remained in some of the Sahara's mountain ranges. As a result, hunting and gathering remained extant there for much longer than the rest of the Sahara, but ultimately, these mountain ranges were the exception. The desertification of the Sahara, of course, impacted pastoral people as well. Rock art from around 3000 BC shows a gradual decline in the prevalence of cattle, in favor of the hardier and less water-intensive goat. But while this adaptation proved successful for several generations, desertification continued to put further pressure on the pastoral Saharans. Eventually, the desert became so dry that the last grasses dried up, leaving behind only oceans of sand and rock, only peppered with the occasional desert shrub. Faced with the increasingly hostile climate, the vast majority of the Saharans opted to leave, heading for greener pastures either on the northern coast, east to the Nile Valley, or south to the Sahel. Among those that remained in the desert, the population coalesced around a few fertile oases and wadis, the last bastions of life in the now mostly lifeless landscape. And it is with these remaining people that the story of the Garamanti civilization truly finds its origins. Join us in our next episode, as the ancient people of the Fezzan face the challenge of adapting from a lifestyle of free-roaming nomadic pastoralism to sedentary agriculture in an extremely isolated and hazardous home. Thank you for listening to the History of Africa podcast. If you like our show, then we would greatly appreciate if you could help support the show and our project of freely available online history education. You can do this by supporting us at patreon.com/historyofafrica, providing us a rating or review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iTunes, or by sharing the podcast with anyone who you think might enjoy learning about African history. This episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including Naomi Kanakia, Ayofagbamie, Dimitri, Alexander Travis, B.B. Milliam, Conrad Schwenke, Johnny Knowles, Godfrey Sebelavie, Pascalon Rococha, Joe Maxwell, Nkechi Nwabudike, Sheuna Laurentimain, Kwajwa Mankwa, Douglas Harder, Craig Bolton, Samuel Badu, Ghassan Firjiani, Niti, Kitty, Tariq Beetleman, and Calvin Jaya Norris, among others. Thank you all for supporting the show. It really, really, really means a lot.